tuned in to Naturopathic Earth Radio with certified health consultant and former obese child, A. Gregory Luna, where you get the latest on clean living, natural remedies, effective weight loss tips, and sound naturopathic principles from experts and biohackers from around the world and Gregory himself. Don't be a slave to Big Pharma. Break free of the shackles of Big Food and start your journey now to a long, vibrant, purposeful life. Become a citizen of Naturopathic Earth.
Hey everybody, this is A. Gregory Luna. You can call me Gregory, of course. Welcome back to another episode of Naturopathic Earth Radio, or NPE Radio. I hope you are doing well today on this Wednesday morn in June. So before we begin and start talking about if antibiotics are making us fat, let's go over all the statistical whatchamacallits. You can find my website at www.naturopathicearth.com. That's N-A-T-U-R-O-P-A-T-H-I-C, naturo and the pathic, or earth. I think you know how to spell earth.com. There you can find all the articles and podcasts and reviews. I just posted a review on dark chocolate. Those have been pretty popular. The one I did on Greek yogurt and non-dairy milk alternatives. So I just did one on the cacao. So check that out. And of course, all the podcasts are over there. Post some comments. I'd appreciate it. Also, you can find me on the Insta at naturopathic_earth, at naturopathic_earth. I just posted a video there when I was at the supermarket showing about the serving size deception in cereals, how the typical cereal serving size is a cup. But some of the sugary cereals, they make 3/4 cup. So when you peruse it really quickly, all the macronutrients and then the nutritional label, you're like, oh, wow, this is less sugar. This has less calories. Wow. Actually, it has the same, if not more, but they've made the serving size smaller, and they're just hoping you don't notice that the serving size is smaller too. So, and then you can find me at Facebook at A. Gregory Luna. The Facebook page is at Naturopath Earth. But to be honest, I don't post that much there. I post more through my name. But not as much as I used to, because I was told I was posting too much. So I'm trying to do only 3 or 4 posts a day. And over on Twitter at Naturopath Earth. And that's where I'm posting a lot of my news feed stuff. I like finding articles. And of course, there's a lot of confirmation bias and all this stuff like that. But I like to post articles that I think will be interesting to the listeners and to the readers. And so there on Twitter, I try to post about 10 or 11 articles a day. And a lot of them are not mine. They're just articles that I find on my news feed that I think are relevant to clean eating or food toxins, or you know, the typical conversation that we have here. All right, now that we got all that knocked out, today we're going to talk about antibiotics. Now, I have talked about antibiotics probably in MPE 2 and 3 when I was talking about prebiotics and probiotics and the effect of antibiotics and what it has on the body. So I have talked about how I'm not a big fan of them. So what I'm going to do today, and the main reason I'm not a big fan of it is because I love probiotics. I'm a lover. I love the probiotics and the prebiotics. So when you take them together, they're symbiotics. I love all those things. So anything that comes in and kills them, not a big fan. Now, that being said, I'm not a big fan of horrible diseases that wipe us out before we had Alexander Fleming inventing penicillin, inventing antibiotics. So, of course, there's a time and a place for antibiotics, but the time and the place is not for all the little minor maladies that we take the large majority of antibiotics for. So this is your throat infection, sinus infection, ear infection, and all these minor BS reasons that we take it because our doctors practice defensive medicine. So when you come in saying you have an earache or sore throat, they want to make sure that they run as many tests as possible because they don't want to miss something. And so they have no problems giving you antibiotics, either A, to guarantee that your return business. Because see, if you go in with a malady, let's say a typical, I don't know, mother goes in and their daughter or son has a malady and the doctor says, you know, ma'am, this is likely viral. Just treat the symptoms. See you later. A lot of parents, some of them would be like, oh, cool, thanks. A lot of parents are like, no, I need to come out of here with a pill. Just like anytime you go to the shrink's office, you got to come out with a diagnosis, right? They're going to say, I need a pill. And so a lot of times the doctors, you know, they're running a private practice. So they're like, okay, I'll write a script. And then, you know, some good doctors, if they do write a script, they'll be like, okay, wait a week. And if the symptoms don't dissipate, then take the antibiotic. But it's a business, so they're going to write the script for, even though they probably know it's viral, or they're just practicing defensive medicine and they want to hedge their bets, and then they write the prescription even though they think it might be viral, or they're not sure. But I've mentioned the American Academy of Pediatrics announced 2-3 years ago that they don't want pediatricians giving antibiotics for ear infections, just because we're worried about the resistant, the super resistant bugs. And I think they're less worried about the microbiome because, you know, the studies coming out microbiomes have been the last 5 years. So the importance of the microbiome is only coming out now. And only certain doctors, you know, integrative medicine doctors, functional medicine doctors are kind of on the forefront, naturopathic doctors, of course. But the typical doctor might not be in the forefront of that knowledge. So they just want to not perhaps prescribe it because of just the resistant bugs. But the more underlying reason and the reason why I'm here is to talk about antibiotics making us fat. Yeah. So what I'm going to do today is a little different than what I've done in the past. Today, I am going to read an article similar to the way I read my confessions and then add anecdotal stuff to it. And so it's going to be a little different. Excuse me for the cough. I didn't press the cough button. Oh my God. Just stop listening. So today we're going to read an article, and I picked this one. This was from The Atlantic, because The Atlantic is a very respectable magazine. Now it's online, since all magazines are going down the road of obsolescence. So this is from The Atlantic, and the title is, Are Antibiotics Making People Larger? Overuse of the drug seems to make us gain weight, even when we don't take them. Now, the reason I chose this article is because I've heard about this most in conspiracy radio back in the day, that antibiotics are fattening us up. And there was this classic study that I remember seeing, and I don't remember where I found it, but it was very bona fide, saying that if you give your kid 3 courses of antibiotics before the age of 3, their chance of becoming obese is 70 times higher. And I was like, that's fascinating, because you never hear about that in the news. You never hear about that, you know, mostly in the mainstream news. And you never hear about that by your pediatrician. So I was like, well, this is kind of abhorrent. So let's address this. All right. And this article is good because it also talks about fecal transplants, which we've talked about in MPE 2 and 3 when we talked about prebiotics and probiotics. Doctors in Newport, Rhode Island had to change one of their policies last year because they inadvertently made a young woman obese. At least because they believe they possibly did. A few months beforehand, the 32-year-old mother, who had never been obese, had developed a vaginal infection. Hopefully she wasn't douching, because that increases your chances of getting it. She took an antibiotic, and as expected, the infection went away. Yay! But shortly after, the woman's stomach began to ache. Boo. A test of her stool found the presence of a lethal toxin. We've long known that taking an antibiotic can inadvertently lead to another infection. This happens commonly in the lungs. In this case, it was an overgrowth of the bacterium Clostridium difficile in the woman's colon. Now, C. diff, we've talked about C. diff before. This is an opportunistic bug, and it's a nosocomial infection. So, like, sometimes you go to a hospital for, like, I don't know, arm surgery, and you contract C. diff. It used to be staph. MRSA was the big baddie bacteria that we used to get. Nosocomial. Nosocomial means you just acquired at a hospital or at a medical facility. Now it's C. diff. C. diff is horrible. It is pretty horrible. Now, it can exist in harmony with other bacteria in our guts. And it's only when it takes over that ecosystem and when the ecosystem is disrupted that by C. diff that it takes over and becomes deadly. But C. diff releases a toxin. And it causes the person's bowels to decay and expand and rupture, and the person dies. And so they're in horrible pain. They have a lot of diarrhea. And annually, it kills about 15,000 people. But the way they used to treat it was with antibiotics, and now we're treating it a little different. So let's talk about this woman. To escape this fate, the Rhode Island woman began treatment to kill the C. diff with another antibiotic. This was the old classic way we used to treat it, right? But again, the antibiotic's going to kill a lot of the probiotic bacteria in the gut, and it doesn't kill the bad one as well. So it's like only the good die young, as Billy Joel used to sing about. She also tested positive for another bacterial infection of the stomach, H. pylori, and that's the one that causes ulcers. So the doctors treated her with 2 additional antibiotics. So of course, these are just A-bombs for your probiotic bacteria. It's just, it's like Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and then they drop the H-bomb later. Just, In a last-ditch attempt to restore balance to her intestinal flora, her doctors recommended a fecal transplant. Now, we've talked about fecal transplants before. So what you essentially do is, now people will donate their feces. So don't think about going home and taking a dump in, you know, on a plate and then using a turkey baster and putting it up somebody's butt that's got C. diff. You have to donate your feces to a lab, and you get like $40 a donation. And then they prepare it and they liquefy it. And essentially they do use a turkey baster. They do it at a hospital, and they use essentially a catheter, and they shoot it up into the rectum of the person who's got C. diff. And the belief is that since that person's feces has got good probiotic bacteria, it's going to help fight the C. diff. So that's the whole idea behind fecal transplants. Now, fecal transplants have been working great for C. diff. They've been working great. So here's we'll get to the point, though. The idea is that the transplanted feces will populate the sick person's bowel with a healthy bacterial population. At the request of the patient, the Newport doctors did not use a professional stool donor. Can you imagine that being on your CV? Oh, I'm a professional stool donor. But instead utilized the excreta of the woman's 16-year-old daughter. Okay, right, keep it in the family like we do with, you know, kidney transplants. The transplant was a success, and that woman's symptoms went away. Yay, so the C. diff went away. The bacterial ecosystem finally appeared to be restored to some kind of order, but they also seemed to have brought something else along. The woman's daughter was obese, and in the months after the transplant, the patient gained 34 pounds, qualifying her as obese for the first time in her life. This case serves as a note of caution, her gastroenterologist later wrote in a medical journal report. We recommend selecting non-overweight fecal donors. Really? You think? That's good. Of course, many things could have caused her weight gain. Treatment of H. pylori, the bacteria that causes most ulcers, is itself associated with weight gain. Infectious disease specialists at Massachusetts General Hospital, Elizabeth Homan and Anna Wheel, noted at the time, quote, it is possible and perhaps even likely that the weight gain in the case reported was influenced not only by microbial communities transmitted during fecal transplant, but also by genetic factors. Here's an interesting thing. In a randomized controlled trial of the reverse scenario where overweight people with metabolic syndrome, it's typically going to be like diabetes, high cholesterol, hypertension, underwent fecal transplants from lean donors. Recipients showed improvement in their degree of insulin resistance, which is related to diabetes. Taken together with other research on the effects of gut microbes on body weight and metabolism, Homan and Wheel concluded in the same journal, quote, these studies take the concept you are what you eat to breathtaking new heights and certainly should stimulate further study. Close quote. Of course, most people who are overweight have not had a fecal transplant. Thank God. Most people will never need a fecal transplant. But the idea that a person can essentially contract obesity because of a change in gut microbes is at once exciting and unnerving, because exposure to microbe-altering drugs in day-to-day life has almost become inevitable. This month, the USDA quietly released a report saying over the past year, antibiotics sold annually for use in food animals increased to 33 million pounds. 33 million. Now, I think some of you already know that the majority of antibiotics that we use in America is given to the cattle. And I've mentioned why, but I'm pretty sure they're going to mention it here too. So the majority of antibiotics that are made by Big Pharma are not made for humans. And honestly, if you look at the research and development at Big Pharma companies, very little of it goes to antibiotics, because antibiotics, they're not making a lot of money off of antibiotics anymore. And you got to go where the money's made. So like chemo, for example. So 33 million pounds, that's a 22% increase since 5 years prior. Usage also increased in 2014 alone, despite several prominent food producers and restaurants like Whole Foods and Chipotle swearing off antibiotic-raised animal products. Yay for those places. Most of those antibiotics are medically important, meaning they are used in humans to treat diseases. But a majority of antibiotics are not absorbed by the animal, just excreted. So even those that are not medically important manage to find their way into soil and water as they become part of the 18 gallons of manure that every cow produces every day. 18 gallons of manure that every cow produces every... Jesus, that is a lot of poop. I didn't know that. Definitely not a farmer. Antibiotics and manure that seep into soil have been detected in carrots, lettuce, and green onions. Okay. So that means we are eating antibiotic-laced food. Now, one of the great conspiracy theories of the past is how they want to put psychoactive drugs in our food, right? Because they want to like dumb down the population. They want to control us. And so one of the ways I think is like by lacing the food with drugs, they can do that. Well, this is like an inadvertent way of getting antibiotics into our food, right? Because it's getting seeped into the poop of the cow. It's inadvertent. Or is it? Some antibiotics remain active for months after passing through the animal and are detected in rivers miles from the use. A study of a river in Colorado found several antibiotics everywhere except for a pristine site in the mountains before the river had encountered urban or agricultural landscapes. Antibiotic overuse turned the Hudson River into a breeding ground for drug-resistant bacteria. Didn't know that. Look, antibiotics, of course, save many lives. And if it wasn't for Alexander Fleming and all the pioneering innovations from antibiotics in the 1920s to the 1950s, I mean, it's a godsend. If you think of all the bacterial cause conditions, I mean, even just go to the STDs like syphilis and chlamydia and all those. But a lot of these horrible drugs that are horrible conditions that affected us in the previous centuries are pretty much gone because of antibiotics. So, I mean, again, we want to give credit to where it is. But now they are given blindly to entire populations to prevent possible infections, which is never indicated medically, even less medically warranted. Actually, contrary to the interests of the animal, antibiotics are given as an appetite and growth stimulant. In the 1950s, shortly after the advent of modern antibiotics, ranchers noticed that cattle that were treated for infections would put on weight. Because ranches are paid by the pound rather than by the number of cattle sold, the idea had appeal. They had ding, ding, light bulb in the head. But in the 1970s, blanket administration of antibiotics to promote growth became common practice. Now, this is something that most people don't know, is that we don't give antibiotics to the chickens and to the pigs and to the cows to prevent disease. Now, granted, the chickens are all locked up in cages where they're going to get infected because they're not getting any sun. Again, listen to my podcast on eggs. And then the cows, the fish, they're all stewing around, walk around their own feces. They're going to get diseased. But the reason they give it is because it fattens them up. I showed that picture once of like what a chicken looked like in 1950, the typical chicken, and what it looks like now in 2010. And how it's double the size. And the chickens now are so big, they're falling over. Their little legs can't support them. And they fall over. So this is why they're getting antibiotics, because it fattens them up. So if it's fattening up the livestock, who's to say that oral antibiotics are not fattening us up? And then who's to say that we eating these animals, because a large majority of us are not eating organic livestock, is not making us fat? Let's continue. Because people so enjoy eating meat and cheese for various reasons. Note the 76 million Facebook users who will watch when BuzzFeed posts a video of a pepperoni grilled cheese sandwich, or the 108 million who watch the bacon-wrapped grilled cheese sandwich. Animals must grow quickly to great sizes in order to accommodate the demand for meat that will serve a planet of 7 billion humans. As the number approaches 8 and then 9 billion, the need for antibiotics and meat production will only be greater. And despite the fact that ranchers have known for decades that antibiotics cause their animals to gain weight, the idea that this has a similar effect on people is somehow just now seeping into the heads of everyone else. Only in the last few years have we begun to understand the extent of the effects of the microbes inside of us and in for our health, or rather as being part of our health. As the microbiologists Rob DeSalle and Susan Perkins wrote in their new book, Welcome to the Microbiome, which is a good title, quote, it's not the microbes that cause problems with our health, but rather disruptions in the natural ecology of our bodies that lead to illness. It is only when the co-evolved ecological balance of our bodies cell with the trillions of microbes living in and on us is thrown out of whack that disease arises. Now, I mentioned those early MPE articles. We have something like 3 trillion bugs on our skin and in our body, and the majority are fine. It's just, again, as they mentioned, when we throw them out of whack. And this may be the first time that the word pathogenicity, which is disease, has been used in the same sentence as whack. Scientists are still figuring out how to talk about this. It was only recently that DNA sequencing technology allowed them to learn that there are indeed trillions of microbes inside each of us, and that in the absence of pathogenicity, the microbiome keeps us healthy every minute of the day, playing significant roles in digestion and assembly of nutrients and vitamins. We've talked about in the previous podcast, also serotonin is produced in the gut, so a healthy microbiome is connected to having better moods. Our immune system is largely made in the gut. It's the second brain, as they say. So again, stronger immune system, stronger heart health. I mean, it's just lots of things about having a healthy microbiome. The idea is only very recently hitting mass audiences. If you've ridden a subway in New York this month, you've seen an ad for a new exhibit about the microbiome at the American Museum of Natural History called The Secret World Inside You. Desylum Perkins are the curators. Of all the things bodily that could belong in a natural history museum, the microbiome makes the most obvious case for itself. The species that live inside us are older than humans by millennia. Dinosaurs had microbiomes. In our internal ecosystems, the ecosystems that we are have been dramatically affected by the food and drugs we put into the natural world and directly or indirectly back into ourselves. All right. Then they have a graph, antibiotic use by country, and the countries that use the least amount of antibiotics are going to be a lot of the Scandinavian countries. So Norway, Iceland, New Zealand, which is not Scandinavian, Sweden, Australia, Finland, Lithuania, Latvia, and so forth. And then at the fatter end, or the more higher use of antibiotics, we got USA, which actually is not the worst, Portugal, Hungary, Italy, España, and Cyprus. Cyprus is the biggie. All right. In May, the German government announced an aggressive reduction strategy. Denmark and the Netherlands have successfully reduced antibiotic use dramatically in the past 5 years. Meanwhile, the use of antibiotics in the United States and most other countries continues to increase. What a surprise. It's like, how many times have we talked about things being banned in the EU but not being banned over here? Like the nitrates, food dyes, you know, but over here in the United States, like the food lobby is so big. They're like, let's just keep it doing it. Teflon, right? We talked about Teflon and the five household toxins you got to get rid of, which I think was like MP11. Yeah, they keep using Teflon here. It's banned over in the EU. Congress did recently vote to increase spending on antibiotic resistance, but none of that money went to the Department of Agriculture. If worldwide use continues at the current rate, by 2030, there will be 211 million pounds of antibiotics going into livestock every year, creating resistant bacteria and bleeding into soil, water, and the food system. So again, we're going to get it. Even if you are eating organic, you're going to get it through the water. Just like they did that really groundbreaking study on how men's testicles are shrinking because so many women are on oral or hormonal contraceptives that it's getting into the water supply, and therefore the men are drinking it. And it's shrinking the testicles because it's too much estrogen. All right. Let's keep going here. Obesity is front and center in America, but also diabetes, fatty liver disease, and some of the cancer pathways. The microbiome can change you very quickly. If I take a rat that is genetically bred to be a skinny rat, and I transpose the stool from a genetically bred fat rat into a skinny rat, I can make that rat fat. God, that sounds like a good rhyme. I can make that rat fat. And the weight goes, anyways, that's my fat boy's beatbox. And the weight goes up within 2 weeks. Okay, so this goes back to the fecal transplant of the woman who got it from her overweight daughter. But again, it happens in rats. So again, there's a correlation. In 2014, Martin Blaser and colleagues at the New York University found that steady exposure of mice to penicillin early in life predisposed them to become obese. I've already talked about that in humans. That and similar evidence has begun to win over many scientists, who comes off even more assured that the relationship is affecting humans. We're animals just like food animals, said Riley. We give them antibiotics so they get fat. We are exposed to those antibiotics. It seems like a very common sense idea that these antibiotics are making us fat too, because we are animals. Riley has dedicated his career to studying drug-resistant infections, especially urinary tract infections and bacteria associated with foodborne illnesses like salmonella. Don't eat the cookie dough. We've always had this idea that drug-resistant forms of bacteria often originate in food animal reservoirs. This argument against antibiotic overuse never really got us anywhere, though. In the meanwhile, he started seeing intestinal microbiome studies that demonstrated that changes in intestinal microbiota are associated with changes in body fat in people. Quote, so I put two and two together, he said, and what happened in this country in the last 20, 30 years where you really see a surge in the obesity epidemic? Well, I don't think there's been a tremendous change in the amount of food people consume. I don't think that's the only explanation. Close quote. What Americans eat has indeed changed in recent decades. The average person eats more now than the average person in 1950. And a person can buy junk food wherever anything is sold. Amen, right? Just go down the streets, all fast food everywhere. And you can go to Family Dollar and rack up on all the cheap packaged junk food. It's also true that many people live more sedentarily day to day than they used to. But even while the food Americans ate in the 1950s was more reasonable than it is now, it was not idyllic. White bread and American cheese and hot dogs and Spam were staples then too. Ooh, Spam, not good. Yeah. The average American now also has a gym membership of some sort. Jogging was not even a thing until the 1970s, much less Zumba, SoulCycle, and CrossFit. Millions of diet books have been sold during the rise of obesity epidemic, proposing every sort of diet-based solution. Despite it all, the problem has only gotten worse. Life expectancy in the U.S. has stopped increasing. Every year, the average person gets fatter. Now, great, this is one of the things we've talked about too, right? We're getting more overweight. What, 70% of Americans are overweight, 30% are obese. And as they mentioned in this article, everybody's got gym membership. We're all working out. We're obsessed with dieting. We just talked about orthorexia in the previous podcast, but we're all getting fatter. So, I mean, we got to look at the extrinsic factors. Is it the antibiotics? Perhaps. Is it the plastics? Plastics are known to make you fat too, to mess with your metabolism. So is it the parabens, the plastic, the phthalates, that whole family of endocrine disruptors? So we have to start looking away from the food, because there are a lot of people that eat very pristinely but are still gaining weight. Is it because they're taking antibiotics? Let's find out. There must be some sort of exposure, quote, said Riley. Epidemics involve common exposure. So I came up with this idea that it's probably the antibiotics in the environment, close quote. He was far from alone in coming to that conclusion. Even though it's not something most people hear about when they're trying to lose weight, numerous scientists have recently come to believe in this hypothesis. Back in 2008, the French researcher Didier Raoult put this together in a journal article, writing bluntly, quote, the current obesity pandemic may be caused in part by antibiotic treatments. Mm-hmm. You are a shy girl. I am Pepe Le Pew. It is time to unshy you with some occupational therapy like making love. Sorry. You gotta love the French. As those antibiotics get into animals and we consume them, either we may be ingesting that antibiotic, or at least it changed the biosis of the animal. So they are effectively a different animal, another processed food, which makes sense. So if you think of an antibiotic being an A-bomb to the cow's microbiome or the chicken or the fish's, and it's wiping them out, they're more likely susceptible to disease, and it just changed their own ecosystem. And so when we eat their meat, we're eating like a washed, vitiated, contaminated version of the actual animal. Only around 30% of antibiotics used in the United States are prescribed to treat humans directly. So I've already mentioned this. Most of the antibiotics are used for the animals. So 30%. So it is a smaller but not insignificant part of the problem that many people still think antibiotics means strong medication that will cure my cold, right? Even though most of the time the colds are viral. People exaggerate their symptoms and lie to doctors in hopes of being prescribed antibiotics. Doctors are miserly by nature and tend to withhold antibiotics, apparently for their own amusement. The thinking must go. Yeah, that's not my experience. My experience is that the doctors write them out like, you know, 12-year-olds write love letters to each other and drop them and hand them to their crushes. I guess they don't do that anymore, right? They text each other. I guess it's a bad analogy. Just scratch the last 10 seconds. Or more likely, the doctor's trying to see the forest for the trees. When you're a tree, though, and you are sick with something that almost certainly caused by a virus against which antibiotics can do nothing, few people care about the forest, right? I mean, it's true. Like when you come in, your kid's screaming from an earache, you're like, just give me a freaking drug. But ma'am, it's a virus. No, give me a freaking drug. Okay, come back. Thank you, come again. Quote, people are always screaming for an antibiotic when they go to their doctor. It's cultural. To go to a doctor and come away with nothing feels like you paid money and didn't get something. Exactly. I just said this earlier. Look, I didn't even steal that. It's true. It's totally true. I mean, we feel like we need to get something for nothing. So it's frustrating. It's like, pop a pill, give me something. As my colleague Ed Young pointed this week prior, which was World Antibiotic Awareness Week. Remember, guys? I'm sure that was in the news, right? World Antibiotic Awareness Week. Even in the face of warnings of 10 million human deaths by 2050, constituting an apocalyptic threat that stands to cast the world back into the dark ages of medicine, almost no one seems to care about antibiotic resistance. In a study where researchers attempted to educate people about the dangers of antibiotic overuse and see which approaches were effective, they found that the interviewees were desensitized to doom-laden warnings. They dismissed them as fear-mongering. As Young recounts, quote, "This term superbugs felt abstract and confusing. It made them think about swine flu or Ebola, threats that either seemed to pass with little incident or happen to people living far away," close quote. It's true. Now, you always think about these things, that, like the Zika was the last like big fear, and you don't really think about it. The newly educated people, in retrospect, recommended that doctors simply tell patients, quote, "Bacteria are getting stronger. Antibiotics won't work anymore. You could die," close quote. That might still feel doomy. What if you told people that an antibiotic could slow their metabolism? Yeah, I'm sure people would stop taking them. Can you imagine that? Like, if they had an insert, I don't even know if they have inserts for antibiotics. Now, if some of you don't know, the antibiotic messes with your birth control. So if any of you ladies are on the pill and you take an antibiotic, just know that it can mitigate the effectiveness of it, and you can get preggers. So watch out for that. But imagine if you had a doctor and the mom's like, please, or, you know, as a woman, I have a horrible throat effect. I need something. I need an antibiotic. Okay, well, this can make you gain weight. And then, phew, they're out the door. Like, the door's like moving still, like the wind of the tumbleweed. It's like, phew, like flash, they're out the door. Because we're so, you know, panicked about weight gain. So, I mean, why don't they start mentioning that? Because most of the doctors don't know that antibiotics could possibly make you fat. They don't know. All right, so a great thing about the microbiome exhibit is that for Perkins and colleagues, it's sort of a living experiment in education. She sees what people react to, what conceptions they come in with, and what they leave with. Quote, "This connection between the microbiome and obesity, when people start to make those connections, I've watched it. They're not happy. They seem like they might be less likely to want to take an antibiotic," close quote. Perkins' own friend was sick at Thanksgiving, and her doctor told her it was just a cold, advising her to rest, drink fluids, and give it time. But no, she told Perkins, who was devoted her professional life to the study of molecular evolutions, that she was just going to take some leftover antibiotics, right? Everybody's got that bottle of leftover antibiotics, right, in your medicine cabinet. And she did. 10 minutes later, she was feeling better, Perkins said, exasperated. "It's like, that's impossible. That's in your head." Then she came to the exhibit last week and was freaked out. Again, telling people that it makes you fat would freak them out. In a video segment at the museum, there's a bit where Stanford microbiologist Justin Sonneberg says that with every dose of antibiotics you take, you do damage to your microbiome. It recovers, but it never recovers to the place that it was before. Actually, the study I've seen is that it takes 2 years for your microbiome to go back to the way it was before. 2 years. So like, again, so I'd be very weary of when you take these antibiotics because they're going to affect your microbiome. We've already talked about all the great things that happen when you have a predominant or preponderant probiotic balance in your gut. So, I mean, why do you want to destroy that? You know, well, you don't. So it recovers, but it takes a lot longer, and then it never to what it was before. Quote, "That seems really to hit people hard," Perkins said. "I think there's an understanding that antibiotics disrupt the microbiome, but it's dismissed as necessary collateral damage. And yes, that's true if you have a real bacterial infection. But thinking in my head, single quote, I'm never going to get back to the place I was before. I will cause the extinction of species and taxa in my gut," she paused. "While I don't think that most members of the public think of it exactly like that in those ecological terms, but the idea that every dose is doing permanent damage really resonates with people," close quote. I asked her if we're at a time when that feeling about antibiotics as a harmless panacea is going to become obsolete. She said, "I mean, I hope so. I don't know. I don't have that much faith in humans in our education at the moment." In talking about the role that antibiotics play in obesity, the burden of proof that the latter is causing the former is extremely high. The meat and dairy industries would need about as much proof as the coal industry would need to be convinced that it's causing global warming. But when you have an epidemic that's affecting 1 in 3 Americans and fueling many of the leading causes of death and medical cost, and you have a plausible mechanism that could be partly behind that epidemic and has been demonstrated in animal models, how long do you wait to act? Well, again, like she said, the meat and dairy industries would need as much proof as the coal industry that's causing global warming. Think of how much money, guys, is involved in shooting our livestock up with antibiotics. It makes them fatter. And as the article mentioned previously, they are weighed by the pound. That was back in the 70s. I doubt that's changed. So there is a profit motive behind making our livestock fatter. And you know, the way you do that is by giving them antibiotics. So think how much money would be involved for them just to be like, yeah, oh, okay, there's a small chance, correlation, causation, whatever, that antibiotics that we're giving our animals is causing all humans to be fatter. We'll just stop. Yeah, okay, then you're Pollyanna living in La La Land. Okay, it's not going to happen like that. Quote, the tricky thing is that we can't do these experiments in humans to prove the same causal link. Okay, they've only been able to do it in animals. Except that we already are. The way that we use antibiotics in the real world, the correlation is very strong. Close quote. But even looking retrospectively, all that anyone can definitively prove is a correlation. Correlation. So, for example, if you take a lot of antibiotics, people who take more antibiotics tend to be overweight, for example. That'd be a correlation. It'd be easy to draw a regression line and say, look, everybody who has had this many doses is this much overweight, Perkins posited. But to really show a mechanism for how a loss of diversity in the gut microbiome translates to obesity is tough. And we know it's not only the only factor, of course, but also depends on what you're eating and how much you're exercising. It's also very difficult to disassociate the effects of antibiotics from nutrition in a study because the more food you eat, the more antibiotics you're exposed to. That's true, right? So it's not easy to scientifically demonstrate this association. Experimentally, you can do it, right? Because you have controls. When you give antibiotics to animals, they gain weight. And there are all kinds of studies showing that antibiotics can be found in food and water. If someone can come up with a nice prospective study, we could do just that. It's just very expensive to do and very difficult to control human diets. For now, Riley is an advocate for consumer incentives. Antibiotic-free meat and dairy are often more expensive, but we might be better off if they were an easy and pervasive option. Well, of course, yeah. I mean, here in Texas, a gallon of milk is $5.50 for organic, but it's $2-something for unorganic, conventional. A pound of ground beef organic here is about $6 a pound and not as $2. So again, with all the healthier stuff, they cost more money. So of course, if they're cheaper and we had more awareness about it, then people would maybe opt for the antibiotic free. But that's not what our livestock makers want us to do. Of course, a person could choose to eat no animal products at all, which has the highest likelihood of preventing obesity. Pescatarians, vegetarians, and especially vegans all have lower body mass indices than carnivores. Yay for the vegans. All the vegans listening are like, yay. Much of the world was up in arms earlier this year when the World Health Organization said that red meat might potentially be slightly carcinogenic. Yeah, remember when that study came out, Time did a big article on it. I covered that. I think in MP 2 and 3 we were talking about probiotics, but processed meat is a known carcinogen. I can't remember which podcast I talked about that. Yeah, I can't remember. Sorry for the crickets. Yeah, but we know that for sure. So all your turkey, your ham, your hot dogs, your Vienna sausages, all that stuff, problematic. So the WHO released a study about red meat being potentially slightly carcinogenic. Okay, look, I'm not going to go and hate on the vegans, but we do need the complete proteins, and meat is what gives it to us. I did mention, I just posted an article on spirulina, which is a great algae protein source, and there are a lot of great vegan sources, like legumes are great in proteins. But to get the complete protein, I think you do need to eat meat. Now, you can be a flexitarian and only eat it maybe a couple times a week, which, you know, I'd be okay with that as your health consultant. But to forsake meat altogether, I don't want to go down this road. See, my voice is getting scratchy. Hold on, let me cough really fast. Hold on. See, that's when I pressed the pause button. You didn't hear that cough I just did right now. Yeah. Sometimes I remember to hit it. Sometimes I don't. What if everyone cared that much about the millions of pounds of antibiotics that go hand in hand with eating meat and are definitely killing and probably fattening us in the process? I mean, that's a good point. So if we had, if CBS and ABC and Fox and CNN and all these things had these constant reports on antibiotics or meat is causing you to get fat partly because of antibiotics in it are causing you to be fat, how many more vegetarians would you have? Probably more. I know, like in my class, anecdotally, every year I went the first day of school, I mentioned I'm lactose intolerant. And then I ask anybody if they're lactose intolerant in class. And I ask how many vegetarians there are. And it, every year it's more and more. So like the younger generations, either because they've been watching too many horrible slaughterhouse videos on YouTube, or their parents are vegetarian, or they don't want to hurt the animal, or there's definitely more vegetarians. But you know, when we watch the slaughterhouse video, because we do watch it in print in one of the classes, and you know, they use a stun gun before they cut the throat. And I tell the students, like, what is a more humane way to kill the animal? If we have to kill an animal to get meat, okay? You don't have to if you're a vegetarian. But if you have to kill one, what's a more humane way? Shooting them? And I always have like the guys were saying, oh, we could shoot them. I'm like, okay, first of all, that's expensive using all those bullets. Plus you'll get fragments everywhere. And you don't want to walk up to the cow, just cut its throat. So the stun gun makes kind of sense. So they try to stun them from behind to shock it. Because when cows are under a lot of stress, they release cortisol, which is the inflammatory hormone made by the adrenal gland. And it gets into the meat, and therefore it could theoretically, when you ingest it, it could make you more stressed out. But I don't know. This seems like specious logic. But we don't want to, you know, we don't want the cow to know it's about to get killed. So they stun him from behind on the conveyor belt. Then they slash it there and turn him upside down, and the blood comes out. But not to gross you guys out. A few years ago, the FDA proposed to have an animal industry do a voluntary restriction on antibiotic use as a growth promoters, This may be happening, but they still use antibiotics. They just call it preventing infection. Yeah. Anytime you ask the animal industry to do a voluntary restriction, you know what they're going to say. Sure, we'll do it. Yeah. Sure. That's the real dilemma, said Riley. There's a misuse of this term. As long as antibiotics aren't specifically used for growth promotion purposes, there's no rule. There's no regulation. While meat and dairy labels now mention antibiotics, no one is actually monitoring these claims unless a product in the grocery store says no antibiotics, USDA process verified. All right. So again, like with vitamins, there's no regulation. That's what I've talked about in milk and in chickens or with eggs when they just say no hormones being used. I mean, there's no stamp to back it up. And even the organic stamp, I mean, it gives it some cachet, you know, gives it some strength behind it. But being labeled natural says nothing about whether or not antibiotics were used, nor does hormones, which according to a segment on the Today Show, apparently some people believe implies that no antibiotics were used. Antibiotics and hormones are different things. Now, we've talked about hormones like recombinant bovine growth hormone, recombinant bovine somatotropin hormone, or RBST, RBGH. We talked about that with Greek yogurt and with dairy, how you want to get that. That's the hormone stuff. And they might have some links to cancer. So yeah, definitely hormones and antibiotics are not the same. Quote, the intent of the FDA was to gradually decrease the overall use of antibiotics. Apparently it's not working, said Riley. You have two of the strongest lobbies in the world, the pharmaceutical industry and the food industry. So change is not going to come from our government. But if people really recognize that the obesity epidemic is associated with exposure to antibiotics, I think demand for antibiotic-free food will become even greater. This is a great line. So two strongest lobbies, big pharma and big food. So, I mean, again, think of the money, guys. You got to smell the money. Where is the money coming from? And big pharma, I mean, they're not going to cut into their profit, their bottom line, and neither is big food. So, I mean, that's a problem. So again, it's got to be more about awareness and just letting people know about this, and then they can make the choice to get organic. But the common man, and I've talked about this, I think it was with Kate in NPE1, how I see a health war coming. We've talked about how there's like racial tension and SES tension, but I see a health tension because if you're listening to this podcast, or if you listen to any podcast, or if you're paleo, keto, clean eating, you know, whatever, vegan, you're in that minority of people. The majority of people in America don't know about any of this stuff, and they continue to eat KFC and French fries. There was that big study that came out yesterday about French fries, greatly increasing your chances of getting heart disease, which we've already known because of the trans fats.
But there's definitely a minority, you can call them the cognoscenti, the literati, the intelligentsia that know about this kind of stuff, but the majority of Americans don't. And so you're going to see the majority of Americans just getting fatter and sicker and dying younger, and then you're going to have like the Whole Foods type living longer, like an Elysium, like living on this levitating island in the sky or something like that. They're going to live longer, and then there's going to be a lot of tension between the two. So awareness is key. So the demand for antibiotic-free food will become even greater, but your paycheck will get lesser. So will the demand for fecal transplants if it can be proven that certain microbial compositions can indeed help to prevent or ameliorate obesity. The mixtures of bacteria that appear to be beneficial are only beginning to be understood, but many experts have high hopes that fecal formulations could one day can be cultured and administered to improve human health in a myriad dimensions. We already know that fecal transplants are a godsend for those with C. diff. And if they're already doing these correlations that if you get a fecal transplant for an overweight person, you become overweight. And if you get it from a skinny person, it can make an overweight person less overweight or have them lose weight. Then hopefully these labs that are doing the fecal transplants are only getting donations from skinny people. That seems to make sense, right? That's good business. Until then, the companies will hawk probiotics and prebiotics with little or no evidence of what direction they may be taking in a person's microbiome. And every January, along with body improvement resolutions, we'll welcome the publication of an onslaught of blockbuster diet books that promise to tell you how you can lose weight without exercising more or eating less. As a rule, that line is always too good to be true. That is true, right? It's always too good to be true. I mean, right now, what was this, the 21-day plan? I mean, how many of these? And look, and I've talked about this in the confession series. Kudos to you. I want you to lose weight. I definitely want everybody to lose weight. It's just that a lot of these, they gain it back so quickly. So you have to change your lifestyle and implement really good biohacks to keep your weight off. And these diets, lots of times the people will have the self-restraint to do it for a little while to lose the weight, but then they gain it back. And maybe they're gaining it back because they go back to eating crap, but maybe it's the plastics, maybe it's the antibiotics. It could be tons of things. It could be tons of exposure. So we're almost done here because I know reading an article is not the most interesting thing. And so right now, I think the big book thing now is the keto, you know, ketogenic, which I love keto. I think keto, all the studies I read on it are corroborating that it does help. You just got to know how to do it. If everyone were exposed to fewer antibiotics, though, that might be an exception. If people at least begin to operate under the belief that this is a real possibility, a convenient side effect might be the aversion of apocalyptic crises. All right. So, what was the goal of this podcast? As with all MP radio podcasts, because the confession series is more of just kind of just helping people who are overweight in high school and like a way to talk about it. The point of the podcast is awareness, guys. Am I saying straight out that antibiotics are bad? No. Okay, when you have whole body infections like sepsis, life or death stuff, definitely take the IV antibiotics. Definitely take them. But the majority of us are taking antibiotics for stupid reasons, to be honest, completely stupid reasons. And we shouldn't be taking them. If for any other reason, it ruins our gut health. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be taking antibiotics because in the back of your mind, you're worried it's going to make you fat. Because again, as this article mentions, it's balance. That doesn't necessarily, there's not proven lockbox study, to quote Al Gore, that antibiotics are making us fat. It's making animals fat. So we're mammals. So just know that it's all about awareness. Is this a possibility? Yes. But the main reason you want to stop taking antibiotics is because it's screwing with your microbiome and it's going to lead to resistant bacteria, which can then be like the super bug and kill us all. So that's what I want the takeaway to be. I'm not fear-mongering, like with the Fidget Spinner podcast. I'm not fear-mongering. I'm not telling us we should build a big bonfire and burn all the fidget spinners. Though probably if they have lead and mercury, that would probably aerosolize them, even though I don't know how that would exactly work. But my point is, it's all about awareness, guys. It's all about awareness. So is there a possibility that antibiotics that we're eating through the animals is making us fat? Yes. Yes, I think this article does a pretty good job bringing that to light with all these scientists that are quoted. So the animals are eating the antibiotics. We're eating the animals. Could that be affecting our gut microbiome? Yes, it probably is. So even if you're taking, you know, very expensive probiotic pills and you're eating Greek yogurt and eating a lot of prebiotic foods, it could still be undermining it, because if you're not eating organic meat, you're still getting antibiotic-laden meat from the cow or the chicken. So is that an issue? Yes. Are antibiotics that you're getting from the doctor making you fat? Maybe yes. Maybe yes. So these are takeaways that I want you to have. It's just know that this is a possibility. So that's all I have to say today. Listen for the next NP Radio. I'm going to do a Q&A pretty soon. So if you have any questions, post a comment on the website or post in something on one of my social media platforms. Until then, take care, God bless, and peace out. Bye-bye.
Listening to Naturopathic Earth Radio. Visit us at www.naturopathicearth.com, follow us on Twitter at Naturopath Earth, and subscribe to us on iTunes. Don't forget to leave a review. And remember our core belief at naturopathicearth.com. Let food be thy medicine, let nature be thy healer. See you next time. Courtesy of Art of Escapism.